history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and sometimes women around you who have some remarkable stories to tell about the things they've done for our sake. And we want to honor our veterans for their service, their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We certainly are educated. We're always entertained and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, like the man we're going to meet today in San Luis Obispo, California, where he spent the last 30 years, 90-year-old, soon to be 91-year-old, Richard Morris, a veteran of the 20th Armored Infantry Division in World War II. Saw some pretty incredible things that we'll hear about, but let's go back to when you were little Dickie Morris in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm sure you loved that nickname, didn't you?
No, never did.
But when you were that age and they called you that, I'm sure you were getting quite an education there in the Midwest. What do you remember about those years that we remember now as the Great Depression? Did it strike you that things were changing in the world or no?
No, when I was a little kid during the Depression, I didn't even realize. The most traumatic thing we did in Iowa was suffer from the heat. We had a hot summer and there was a drought in the whole Midwest and farm crops were bad or not existing, and that's what I remember. When it got terribly hot, Mom would fix our dinner on a table in the basement since the whole house was hot. Often we would get up, as I remember, it would be 105 and by noon maybe 112, and this went on week after week for that summer. So I guess I'm not so concerned about the warming of the earth now.
Well, you never have to deal with that in San Luis Obispo. It's always wonderful temperatures here, and I bet nobody knows what a basement is around here either.
That's correct. Nobody in California, well, hardly anybody has a basement.
When you were a young boy growing up in Des Moines, do you remember what kind of ambitions you had or what the ideas you had about your future were?
I guess I've always wanted to be a writer. To give you a funny example, I suppose I was in my early teens when Roosevelt was president, and I read the paper and I read all the criticisms about him, and it got so it bothered me so much I wrote a letter to the editor and I said, we shouldn't be saying such terrible things about our president and whatever else I thought was good. And my dad was working in the Polk County Courthouse, and he was a Republican. And in the newspaper, when you wrote a letter to the editor, if they published it, they put your name and address. So one day he went to work, and all these people asking him, is this your son that's writing these these Democratic letters? Yes, it was. And the truth was, Dad in his heart was a Democrat, but the only way to get a job at that time in the courthouse was to be a Republican.
So you were writing back then. I have a feeling you've done some writing recently, too. I like to ask you every veteran about a specific date because you all seem to have one kind of memory or another of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out that America had been attacked?
That morning, it was a Sunday morning, and I was on the floor listening to a radio program. And the program was interrupted by an announcer said that America had been hit, the Japanese had hit Pearl Harbor. So I went into the kitchen. I said, Mom, where is Pearl Harbor? And she said, I never heard of it. And I suppose in a few days, we really began to find out. But I can remember thinking, well, that's so far away, that won't hurt us, even though the Japanese are attacking Pearl Harbor. And I think most of Americans didn't realize how important that was. But in my senior year in high school, this was a big high school, and we had about 500 in our graduating class. And I think perhaps 90 or even more percent of all the guys went into the service after we graduated. Mm-hmm. Some volunteered, some were drafted, but just like all of us, evaporated from the home area.
And tell us how it happened for you, that Uncle Sam got a hold of you and you became part of the Army.
In my senior year, the Army had some literature and given to all the high school people, I suppose. A friend said, you should go over and check this ASTP, Army Specialized Training Program. And so I did, and didn't think anything more about it. But apparently that decision was immediately picked up by the Army. And then when I went to the induction center and then the Army base where we got our clothes and so forth and our shipping orders, I was the only guy that got on a train from Des Moines to Chicago. And I thought that was strange. And then from Chicago to Atlanta, Georgia, and then to Fort Benning, Georgia. It never really hit me that this was anything special. I thought everybody went through a base camp experience, and I just thought nothing of it. Only when we got there did I find out they were serious about us being better, you know, the best soldiers and all that kind of stuff. I was a good soldier, except one thing. I couldn't walk in step with the rest of the guys. Sergeant Sisel, I'll never forget him. I liked him very much, and I think he liked me, but I frustrated him so bad that he kept yelling at me, "Morris, get in step." And then he came over, he said, "Listen, you don't seem to understand what in step means, do you?" I said, "No, Sergeant, I don't." And he said, "Well, let's try 25 push-ups and see if that'll help you." I did the push-ups, and it didn't help me at all, because later in life I found that one leg was shorter, about a half inch shorter than the other, and that's why I couldn't walk in step. And poor Sisel was wasting his time.
Was there anything else about that training at Fort Benning that rocked your world a little bit, that you hadn't been exposed to before, or that made you say, "Boy, I don't know what I got myself into here"?
Well, one thing I will always remember, and as will all the guys that went in training there, there were pine trees with long needles, and there was just a red sandy soil. There wasn't any grass on it. So every day we had to go out and police the area, and that meant pick up every needle from the tree. They were dropping needles all the time, and we used to get disgusted. We said, "Why don't you just wait till they, you know, get a bigger pile of them, and we'll rake them up." No, we had to clean it every day. We had to keep the barracks super clean, especially the floor, to teach us to work together. I think if one guy slacked, you were always supposed to clean your own area of the floor. And if one guy didn't do a good job, sergeant would say, "Okay, everybody, we're going to do it all over again until you get it through your head what the clean floor looks like." So we do it over again.
And you mentioned the ASTP, and we've had a lot of veterans on this program who were part of that, and we're really grateful for the chance to have some college classes and work on their education, and it sounded like such a great idea. And I'm sure it was exciting for you to go off to Indiana University. What were you studying there?
I guess it was a curriculum close to what West Point is like, kind of, and the major was to be civil engineering, I think. It made us feel very good because the administrative lounge where we could all rest had a bar in it. We could get beer, and that was great. And we were horsing around one day, and I lunged back and hit my head on the corner of our steel beds. Then I fell to the ground and cracked my skull, and I was bleeding all over, and they took me to the hospital and held me for a day or two to see if I was gonna be demented or something. It didn't really worry me, and it's never bothered me since, but anyway, you could call that a baptism of fire. And what else do I remember about that? I hated one course, and I didn't get a good grade in it, and I was kicking myself. It was a course where we were studying weather, the things that different clouds would tell you about the weather. For some reason, that didn't interest me, and I'm afraid I didn't take it seriously.
Well, and the deal changed when it came to the ASTP, because they got to a point where they didn't need college students, they needed bodies overseas. When did you realize, how did they break the news to you that this was coming to an end and you were going to be needed elsewhere?
After we were given a home leave for Christmas, I think when we got back is when they told us we're just going to pack up and go to Camp Campbell, Kentucky, and we were going to form a new armored infantry division. We all wondered if there were 20 armored divisions up 19 before us, and the answer is no, there weren't. That was one way the Army tried to fool the enemy into thinking we actually had 20 armored divisions. But we did have the 20th Armored Division. I was in it.
Yeah, you helped form it there at Camp Campbell in Kentucky. And you mentioned about your baptism by fire with getting your head smashed up there in that accident, but you experienced something even more tragic there at Camp Campbell. What did you see there, and how did that kind of change your outlook?
The first time I had ever seen many buddies killed, we were supposed to report to a firing range. The lieutenant of our platoon, he wasn't as fast in making us get on the half tracks and move out, so we were a little bit late. I happened to be in the first half track, and I was standing up, and the lieutenant said, keep pumping your arm faster and faster, because he was trying to make up time. We had like a 90-degree turn on the gravel road, and the half track behind us just slid off the road and rolled over and killed about half the guys in the half track. In spite of that, we went out and had our firing experience. We had a interesting experience, but I don't think we saw so much fun in it.
You know, I've had some guys tell me that they would have been content to stay stateside the whole war and never go overseas, and other guys were chomping at the bit to get over there and get a piece of the action. Where were you on that spectrum? Were you eager to do something and get overseas and be a part of this?
I guess you could say I was a dumb Midwestern kid, because I thought it was all exciting. I wasn't a bit concerned about getting into the service, and I was in a very happy mood when we were going to be going overseas. I thought that was going to be exciting. And I thought going overseas, going in some big ship would be exciting. Like, only rich people did this, you know.
Because you had never been on a ship before, probably, huh?
I had never been on a ship. I had never been out of Iowa before I was actually drafted. A buddy and I were playing chess, a little tiny chess set, on the stairs of a dining room that was full of double bunks of soldiers. And we were going through a terrible storm, and the waves were higher than the ship. And it was an old Norwegian luxury liner, and every time we'd go into a wave, the whole ship would shake. And Bob and I decided it's probably not safe to be down here. We better get on deck above. And the irony of that is, if the ship had been hit in a storm situation like that, we would have probably all drowned, because we weren't issued any life jackets or anything like that. But I remember we got up on the top, saw this terrible storm and these huge waves, and Bob and I were going to go to the edge to look over the edge of the ship, and some guards up there said, don't get near the edge. Get a hold of something solid and stay in the center. And so that's how we weathered that. Well, I want to tell you, then it was exciting to go overseas in a long convoy. We were escorted by Navy ships. But anyway, we landed in Dieppe, France.
When you got to France, it was just after the Battle of the Bulge had wrapped up. And a lot of people, you know, think, oh, well, after the Bulge, you know, all the momentum was on America's side. There wasn't that much more to do. I think you probably have a different story to tell. What did you encounter when you got there, and where did you receive your first taste of combat?
While we were waiting to be given orders to move out, the only training we got was how to guard against tripping little wires. The Germans would plant little explosions, which would go up in the air, and the pieces would hit you in the middle of your body. And that's the only training we've been given about the dangers that we were facing.
Were those the bouncing Bettys? Is that what they called them, those mines?
I think that's exactly what they were. We were first assigned to the northern area of Germany. At that point, the British and the Americans were ready to invade Germany proper. And Montgomery was supposed to go on the northern side of Germany, and Patton was on the southern side of Germany. I learned later that Montgomery was meticulous about getting ready to attack somebody. I also learned later that the American generals were disgusted that he wasn't moving out as quickly as ours were. But I'm sure the example that Patton set was hard to match, because Patton, when he made up his mind he was going to do something, he did it. And his intentions, as I learned later, were to go all the way across southern Germany and then go up toward Berlin and to capture Berlin before the Russians did. He also wished to precipitate a war with Russia. He thought the communists were the worst thing in the world. While America was strong, he wanted us to fight Russia. Anyway, we were rescheduled, so we went down through Germany to go down to the southern part of Germany. On the way down, one day, our whole company was in a convoy of half-tracks. The MPs pulled our half-track aside and made us 10 guys guard a fence. They were putting up a fence quickly because they had literally thousands of prisoners they were taking as German prisoners. So they asked us to stand along the side of the fence to hold the fence up until they got some poles in to keep the fence up. And while I was standing there, a German guy came over and in broken English said, can I report a war crime? I said, yes. And I said, what is it? He said, one of my buddies had his finger cut off to take his ring. And I said, really? I didn't believe it. And he motioned to the guy to come over, and he took the handkerchief off his stump and he showed me his ring finger was cut off. And I thought, good grief. But anyway, that was a sign of how we could be as ruthless, I guess, as the enemy in a certain way.
Well, you would see the textbook in Nazi cruelty before you left Europe. What about combat? Did you get to a point where there was enemy artillery in the area or where you had to fire some of your weapons?
This is a story that takes one day, takes 24 hours. In the morning, we were getting ready to fall into a column, and a number of vehicles were moving south, and we were going to be in position to attack Munich. That was the day that I said our half-track was pulled out to help guard an enclosure of prisoners. And since we were delayed, and since I was the guy, it was the map guy, I said, in order to catch up with our main outfit, let's go down a gravel road. And so we went down a gravel road. It was beautiful rural countryside. And all of a sudden, we came into a huge high-walled enclosure. And it was huge enough that it actually, from the view that we were looking at it, it covered up most of the camp. It was a Dachau concentration camp. We didn't know about that. We didn't know about concentration camps.
What a horrible place that was. And little did you know what you had stumbled across. It's time to take a break, but when we come back, Richard Morris will share exactly what he experienced at that infamous site where more than 40,000 people had been murdered during World War II. We'll also learn how those memories have truly haunted him ever since. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with Richard Morris of San Luis Obispo, California. Originally from Des Moines, Iowa, he served with the 20th Armored Division during World War II, getting over to Europe toward the end of the war. When we left off, it was April of 1945, and in trying to catch up with other elements of the 65th Armored Infantry Battalion, he took a shortcut toward Munich and stumbled across what he would later learn was the infamous Dachau concentration camp. Neither Mr. Morris nor any of the men with him had ever heard of it or were even familiar with the concept of a Nazi extermination facility.
Anyway, as we got close to where the doors were on this wall enclosure, they opened up and several men came out waving at us in those dirty pajama-like outfits, striped outfits, and they kept waving. So I told Sam, our driver, I said, stop for a minute and I'll run up and see what this is. So I went up and they hugged me, and they were so full of joy, and I didn't realize, you know, that we were the sign that they would be saved. And while they were holding on to me, they drugged me inside the doors. They pulled me right behind an oven and opened the door and made me look inside to see there were bodies in there. They were going to pull me to the next oven, and I noticed a huge pile of dead bodies, higher than I was, and I thought, my God, what is this? And the only thing that came to mind was they must have the Black Plague and they're cremating them to kill the germs. And so as they were pulling me in to see more, I started pulling away to get away from it and get out. And I finally got out and went back to the half track and I said to the lieutenant, do you want to see what this is? No. When I told him, he said, no, I don't want to see it. So he said, get on the radio. Well, I said, All I can tell you, there's a lot of sick men in that part of this enclosure. And so I got on the radio, and when I started to talk about it, I couldn't even explain. I said, you know, I'm giving you the coordinates of a place where there's some very sick people. They need medics. And that's all I could say about it. That same day, because we were out of our column, we got into a line of vehicles that was a mixed. We had a 2.5-ton truck in front of us. We had a tank behind us. Well, anyway, in the middle of the night, I got hungry. I don't think I had anything to eat all day. And so I got into our sea rations, little cans about the size of cat food. I got something, I think it was beans and ham. And anyway, it made me sick, so I got out of the half track to throw up. I carried my blanket with me, and I put my rifle, I hung it on my shoulder upside down so it wasn't sticking up. And I covered myself up with this blanket, and I decided, I just need a walk. I think I'll walk up this convoy and see what's on it. It was just a variety of things. Many who looked like they were out of their unit, like we were. So anyway, I got back, and I decided to walk in front of us, and there was only a 2.5-ton truck in front of us. And I walked around it, and two guys in there were sleeping. So I pulled the door over, and I said, what in the hell are you doing stopping here? And they said, because there's a little bridge up front that's been bombed. It's not safe for us to cross it. So I went up and checked the bridge, and I thought, I think it's wide enough. Anyway, I thought it was wide enough for a half track. Just then, a lieutenant from the tank came up. He said, sir, can I help you? And I thought, well, yes, as long as I'm in control of things, yes. I said, get this 2.5-ton truck off the road. I said, we're going to go ahead with the half track, and you and everybody behind us can just follow us. And so we got over it okay. I told Sam, I'm going to walk in front of you. And we had flashlights that had slits in them. I'd get far enough ahead that he could see the slit, but also could see where the road was. So I led this whole column of mixed vehicles. We came to a T-crossing. I was out there in front by myself, and the guy said, halt, what's the password? And I said, I don't know what the hell the password is, but I'm from Iowa, and I want to know where the half tracks have gone that came by this corner. He said, I never saw any half tracks. So I thought, oh, good. I shouldn't say this, but the lieutenant didn't know as much as we did. He was a 90-day wonder who got to be a lieutenant by graduating from college. And so we asked him what he thought we should do, and he said, let's go to the right. So we went to the right. We'd gone about probably 3/4 of a mile, and Sam said, we got to find a place to stop. We're running out of gas. So there was a farmhouse, and in Bavaria, farmhouses had the barn right next to the house. It was as clean as a house. Well, anyway, lieutenant goes in and decides he's going to take possession of the house so we can sleep on the beds. There were two women in the house, and she immediately started screaming, and they were grabbing these down quilts, and they were carrying on. So the lieutenant said, all right, get out of here and take them up the road. So after taking everything good out of the bedrooms, we decided to sleep in the barn, and the half track went on one side of the building, and we had a guy on guard on the other side of the building. And I suppose this was about 4:00. Well, we all settled down, the rest of us settled down in the barn on straw, and we were just getting to sleep, and pretty soon our 50 caliber went off. The irony of me in the corner of this barn trying to take a crap when the 50 caliber machine gun goes off, I can't explain to you. I got up and got dressed as fast as I could, and grabbed my gun and got outside, and I went to the half track, and a young buddy named Duffy from Brooklyn was on the half track, and he said, I just saw some German soldiers coming across the field. It was just clear enough that he could see them. Well, he said, halt, and they didn't halt, so he just started shooting, and a couple of them stood up and held their arms up, and we assumed the other three were killed. So anyway, two guys came forward, and one, I'm pretty convinced, was an SS officer. He'd taken off the insignia, but he had an SS officer's outfit on and everything. The other guy was an ordinary guard. The guard kept his hands up, and he kept shaking. He was shaking so bad, we told him and the officer to sit down on the ground. Both of them, we offered them some hot coffee and some cigarettes. The irony is, I think they thought we were going to kill them. Nobody had told us what to do with prisoners. And we didn't feel like killing them because we thought they suffered enough by having their buddies killed. Anyway, I walked up to this officer and I noticed a large hunk of his shoulder, his arm, about 3 inches below the shoulder, had been cut out by a 50 caliber. And when it hits the flesh, it just cut a neat strip out of there. I looked at it and I thought, that's amazing. That's flesh almost deep enough to go to his bone. I pointed it out to him and he said, well, he just was ignoring the pain, I think. So I had him take his jacket off, and all of us had little first aid kits, which were a bandage and little packages of sulfur. So I sprinkled the sulfur on it and put the bandage around it. I think the lieutenant says, well, what are we going to do with these guys? And we had no place to put them on a half track. So by that, it was light enough, we could see another farmhouse down the road. And we said, just go on down there. The ladies will take care of you. And so we let him go. I honestly believe we might have been dealing with the guy who was in charge of the Dachau concentration camp. He seemed like a perfectly nice guy. He was, you know, overwhelmed by our kindness. And the guy whose arms were shaking never did stop shaking, but they both left and walked down the field.
And explain to us why you believe that. I mean, I'm sure it has to do with the fact that he was an SS officer and the proximity to the camp, because you're still pretty close to the concentration camp at this farmhouse, huh?
The logic of finding them there became clear to me as I thought about it. The Dachau concentration camp is north of Munich, and we were going south to get closer to Munich. And I think these guys and perhaps other officers from the camp went through a woods. And so by the morning we were at camp there, they start coming out of the woods. Those would be the only officers I could think of that would be in the area.
And because when you were in the camp, as you stumbled upon it, had never even heard of this idea of a concentration camp, didn't know what was being done to the Jews and those other political prisoners, you didn't see any officers there. All you saw was prisoners, right?
Exactly. And another thing, we had never been given much information about the clothing or the appearance of German soldiers and officers. I only learned this later when I did find out what German troops looked like and their officers. But the SS troops, as far as I was concerned, were the elite officer corps. And I think this man was in that rank. I'll never stop wondering, how come that feeling that we were going to be there to kill the German soldiers and win the war, how come we were not more angry at them? I think it was because we were all young and we all had not been... They never talked to us about what to do with dead bodies and with people that we might capture. They never talked to us about that, so we honestly didn't know what to do. That day, we went into Munich, and Munich is the capital of Bavaria, and I learned later, Bavarians never really liked the Nazis, and they didn't like the Prussian attitude about fighting all the time, but they had go along with it because Hitler had his forces were strong enough to stop anybody from disagreeing. But as we entered the city of Munich, people were putting their white sheets out of their windows and waving them at us to let us know they were happy and, you know, happy that we were coming and in a sense had saved them. Well, what else would you like to know? We're getting close to the end of my story.
We are, and I know some of it is easier to talk about than others, and I don't want to make you dwell on it, but it's been 70 years since that happened. It's been 70 years since all those concentration camps were liberated. And there are even people today who believe that it never happened, that these atrocities were not committed, that 6 million Jews and so many others were exterminated. But you saw it firsthand. So as painful as it might be to discuss, can you tell us what you saw, what kind of shape these human beings were in, and how devastating it was to witness all of that?
Yeah. I would say the whole scene and all of the men, and maybe there were about six that were actually in the crematorium working in there, and they looked like skin and bones. And as I think back about what I know about the Dachau concentration camp, they were the healthy ones. They were the ones that were expected to lift bodies, put them in the ovens. I learned later in the Dachau concentration camp, it was built in 1938, right when Hitler started, and it was to be a prototype for other concentration camps. However, it didn't have a cellar where they gassed people. The camp was built for about 20,000 people. When it was liberated, it had about almost 40,000. For every barracks, let's say a barracks had 100 men. In every barracks where they had beds for 100 men, there would be 100 dead people also in those barracks. The Germans just let them lay there. Anyway, what that did to traumatize me, all my life I have had nightmares about somebody pulling me somewhere on my arm. And only recently did I begin to realize there's a connection with those guys pulling me into that crematorium to look at all that. It was sufficiently troublesome that I kept falling out of bed when I was sleeping with my wife, so I started sleeping on the floor rather than falling out of the bed. And I'm sure she thought it was because I didn't love her or something, and to me it was equally confusing. But up until recent years of my life, if I have a nightmare, that's the one that scares me. And in this house, I've fallen out of the bed several times, thinking I'm being pulled towards something I don't want to go to.
So you still get those nightmares 70 years later of people tugging on you and pulling you somewhere you don't want to go.
That kind of a reaction I have learned is a PTSD type reaction. And that type of trauma cannot be dealt with by medicine alone. All you can do is kind of calm yourself down. And so that's what I've been doing. And the problem is, when you get out of the service, you don't talk to anybody. But I don't think I ever told anybody about the details of my experience in the crematorium. So we don't think about it. I probably should mention, though, that the captain of our company was a really nice guy. After the captain who wanted to be Napoleon, we got a really nice guy. He was a high school principal. I just liked him very much. I think he got concerned about me because before I even left Europe, I was getting terribly depressed. By the time we got to Vandenberg, there was an army camp built in the Vandenberg area, Vandenberg Air Base. It was built for half tracks because we were going to practice landing LSD boats on the shore. We learned before we actually left that camp that we were the invasion groups, and we were to be the first ones to land on the mainland of Japan.
And we're going to find out how you knew that and what further details you were given when we come back from this break. We'll also hear another eyebrow-raising story from Richard Morris's time in Germany with the 20th Armored Division. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and what has been an entertaining, at times very heavy, and informative journey with Richard Morris, a recipient of the Bronze Star and veteran of both World War II and the Korean War. For more than 30 years, this Iowa native has made his home in San Luis Obispo, California, where Hometown Heroes airs every Saturday at 2 on affiliate KVEC. That's 920 on your AM dial if you find yourself on California's Central Coast. We heard him share so powerfully about his experience at the Dachau concentration camp and the burden of recurring nightmares he's carried over the 7 decades since. And you had another unforgettable encounter at the end of the war in Europe.
In Germany, right after the war ended, our company was sent to a small village right on the edge of the Alps, and it had been a primitive type of ski resort. When we pulled guard duty on the crossroads outside of that little village, the village was called Repolding. On the outside, where there would be road crossings, we posted like 2 guys, and we would build a little fire there. We just have to stay during whatever shift of guard duty we had to play. Pretty soon, Germans were coming to us asking if we'd like souvenirs for food. And so I got a real nice camera. It was probably the most advanced thing at the time. But anyways, the kind that folded open and had the lens out front, and they had even a remote control for pulling the shutter. And I got the camera, and then the guy came by the next couple of days, said, "Would you like some film?" And I said, "Sure, I'd like some film." I gave him some more oranges and apples. I got enough film. I began to take pictures. And then I said to someone in town, where do you take pictures to get them developed? And he said, "In that German farmhouse out there on the side where the barn is, there's a guy that develops pictures." So I go walking out there by myself, which is a terrible thing to do. We were always told to go 2x2 and carry a weapon. So I got out there and I went in, and there was a big German, a burly guy that looked like a butcher, but he was working on a table in kind of the back of that barn space, and he had a counter up here. So anyway, I finally said, "Will you develop my pictures?" And he said, "Yes." And I was able to understand he meant to come back tomorrow and I'll have the pictures for you. So I went back tomorrow by myself again, and he was at the other side working, washing something. Beside this counter was a huge drum. I think it was probably 4 feet off the ground, but it was moving slowly and it was heated. And on it was covered with a whole bunch of pictures. And so I moved over and I looked at it. I thought, "My God, that looks like Hitler." And as a matter of fact, it was Hitler and the woman he married and the 2 people they had as witnesses when they were in the bunker and got married. Of course, I had no idea that where Hitler actually died. I thought, well, he must be in this area after developing pictures for him. So the guy saw me looking at the pictures and he started running for the other door that went into the house. I took my rifle down. I said, "Stop. I want my pictures." So he came over and he handed my pictures, and we had German script at that time, a little like Monopoly money. I started giving him some money. He said, "No, I don't want any money. You can have the pictures." And I thought, if I leave this building, it's a good chance I will be shot for what I've seen. So I ran back to the camp, our captain's headquarters. The officers were all gone, and the sergeant listened to me, and he said, "Do you think this is real?" I said, "Yeah. If you want to go out, you may find the pictures." He said, "I'm not going out there." I said, "Well, then why don't you call our captain and tell him what we have and see what they think?" In about 20 minutes, down the road comes our captain and our lieutenants and then the major and then the colonel and then the general. I tell them what I've seen, and they say, "Take us out there." And I thought, "Oh, I'll be in the front. They'll kill me for sure." So I took them out, and finally we got about 100 feet from the door, and I said, "I'm not going in there." So the guys with all the ammunition jumped up and went in. That's the last I heard about that. When I arrived in New York Harbor at one of the main piers, I was getting off the ship. The boys on the dock were yelling, "Extra, extra, last picture of Hitler alive, and A-bomb dropped in Japan." Those 2 things were on the front page of the New York Times. And I grabbed the paper and I thought, "That is my picture. That's the picture I should have grabbed." Anyway, that's how things sometimes happen. You find it's a small world after all.
So you're pretty confident, though, that the photo you saw on that newspaper when you got into New York City was the very same photo you'd seen in Germany?
I'm sure it was. That picture so impressed me that I wasn't going to forget it. And when I saw it on the front page of the New York Times, I thought, that is my picture. And why was I so stupid? Because there were a number of pictures like that. I could have just pocketed one, you know, without the guy watching me. But my standing there and looking at it, I'm sure I looked a little bit shocked, and he was also shocked that I would find out.
Now, you started to tell me how you knew that you guys would have been some of the first guys in the invasion of Japan.
After we had assembled at Camp Cook, we hadn't been in the camp even a week, and the order came down that we were to have a large assembly meeting with the general out in the field. Those of us that were there were probably the 65th Armored Infantry Battalion. All of us had half tracks, and in the actual invasion, tanks would join us. Right. Anyway, the general had a stand that he could stand on with loudspeakers, and so he said, "I'll tell you the good news first." He said, "The good news is the Army has deactivated this division, and you're all going to go home." And of course, we all cheered. And then he said, "Now, the bad news is, fortunately, you do not have to experience it." He told us generally that we were to invade a certain shore area of Japan, the mainland. And he said, "Before we leave here today, your captains have the actual invasion orders in a packet, and they're going to show it to you and read it to you." So each captain of every outfit did that, and when our captain opened it, he said, "I guess I might as well tell you in the beginning that the odds of your surviving, either wounded or being killed, are probably 70%, and only maybe 30% of you will be able to continue fighting in the invasion." And he said, "The only reason we can say that to you is because we know that the Japanese will fight to the end if we invade their homeland." And he said, "I'm going to show you your individual areas of attack, and I'm going to show you what routes you were to follow if you got on the land itself." And so they showed us all that. We went to our barracks, and they said, "You will be processed for discharge." Oh, by that time, the captain was so concerned about Morris getting so depressed, he made a decision to do what he could to help it. I think he thought I was afraid to go to Japan. That wasn't what I was afraid of. I was having these nightmares, and I was depressed. And in order to help me, he transferred me out of this infantry division to the division finance office. They gave me a rating of a sergeant. So my last experience in the 20th Armored Division was auditing all the payroll lists, but never during any of the time I was in the service did anybody even talk to me about, "Why are you depressed? And you know, what are you afraid of?" Yeah. And he knew that I was not the kind of a guy that got afraid of anything. Anyway, because I had a sergeant's rating, I thought, "Wow, this is terrific." So in college, I joined the reserves to preserve the sergeant's rating. I went to Drake University in Des Moines. My senior year, I joined the reserves, and I started attending the meetings. I started teaching school for 1 year, and the next year, I got a letter from Truman. He said, "You are hereby called to serve your country by reporting to Fort Hood, Texas." I didn't think that was such a bad idea, but our superintendent of schools thought it was terrible. And he drove me into the headquarters in Des Moines and said, "You can't take this fellow. He's teaching. We just started." And the colonel just looked at him. "I'm sorry, but there are no excuses. If he's on this list, he has to go." So I went to Korea.
Yes, and you would be awarded the Bronze Star in Korea, but timing is everything. Your arrival there was delayed because of a bout of appendicitis in Texas that put you in the hospital for almost a week. As a result, you didn't go over with your buddies, and you got there a little later. And maybe that appendicitis saved your life, because you received some pretty jarring news after you arrived in Korea.
The guy who was sort of the harbor master looked at my papers, and he said, "Oh, you go to headquarters. You have to go back up to the front." And he said, "There's a little train here. It's original train. Operates in Korea. Any soldier has a right to get on the train and ride free." I got on the train, and I got to see the countryside of Korea, which it looks very primitive. The houses are primitive, and everything is primitive. The train stopped at every little village, and at every little village, Koreans were right by the train track with peanuts and apples, two things I really loved. So I kept getting the peanuts and apples. We didn't go to Seoul because Seoul was actually being taken by the North Koreans at that time. So anyway, at the end of the train, I guess I got a ride with some Jeep or some truck to where headquarters was. And so I reported to the headquarters and I showed my papers and some guy said, you have to go over to the Quonset where the general is. So I went in and the general was, I think his name was Walker. He was smoking a cigar and he was holding a miniature dachshund. Yeah. And he was walking back and forth. And my first order in Korea was to get him a cup of coffee. So I got him a cup of coffee and handed it to him. About that time, he started swearing at the colonel, who was standing at a raised desk with a big map. And he was in charge of giving orders for the movement of any unit. The general swore. He said, are you going to wait until we get captured? What in the hell's the matter with you? We're supposed to be the first people out of this area. By that time, the machine guns were getting louder. I thought, wow, that would be a terrible experience. I have just arrived. We're going to be arrested. We're going to be captured. Thank God we weren't. But anyway, we finally got out of there. So after a week or so, I was in headquarters, and I was in information and education, and I was assigned to write the newspaper for all the American troops in Korea. But anyway, I wanted to find out how my buddy was. I knew what outfit he went to, so I called there and asked if you could get a message to him. He checked and he said, I'm sorry. He died one day after he arrived. He was killed. Oh, man. I could have been right there with him. So I feel I've been very lucky in my experiences in the Army. I nearly got killed in Germany when an MP came up to our half track and he had a grease gun. We call them burp guns. He was twisting on his shoulder and pulled the trigger, and the bullets went right by my ear. I thought I was hit, and I stopped for a minute. I thought, well, am I going to stop breathing? He was scared to death that he had killed me.
Well, is that your explanation, that you're still here, that you saw everything you saw and lived through everything? Is it just sheer luck, or what do you think?
No, it's not sheer luck. My mother is a simple French Catholic woman. She was raised in an area where there were no churches or anything, and the family, I guess there were about seven kids, and all her mother used to teach the kids is learn to say the rosary. So I found out after I got back that my mom drove everybody crazy. She wouldn't do anything but pray the rosary. And there were times when she'd say, it's very important that you pray for his safety. And so the times that I came close to probably being killed is when she got the message, you know. So I was saved by the rosary, and my mom prayed it constantly. From the time I went in the first time, the second time, it really nearly broke her down to being immobile, like with depression, at the thought of me being killed.
Well, I know we're about out of time here, but I don't want to forget to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing authentically from your experience. And I'm so grateful that you're able to share something. You know, we think about Purple Hearts and guys who come back without a leg or they've got a bullet wound or a scar that we can see. But so many came home with scars that no one could see. And you were sharing some of that very transparently with us. I think it's important for all of us to hear that. In light of that, is there some advice or some wisdom you can share with people who have been coming back from our current wars in similar states or those like you who it's been 70 years, but it's still a battle with PTSD? Is there something you've learned or you've experienced that you think could help others?
After my second tour to Korea, I became a pacifist. I just said, war is insanity. When I realized how terrible the war was for the guys and how many ways they were injured and how many had PTSD, I began to wonder how can we keep subjecting our American men and women to this kind of trauma? Because they're coming back and they're sick for the rest of their life. I realize PTSD, how bad it is, because it generally weakens you. Your whole immune system, psychological and physical immune system, is weakened. So any other things that add to it can trigger a real depression or another illness. So as I heard about all these guys coming back, I just started praying for them. I thought, this is the worst thing we could do to our young people. I just feel terrible about young American men and women having to go to wars like that.
One more question I don't want to miss out on, and I don't know what your answer is. That's why I asked the question. You told us how you stumbled across the Dachau concentration camp. There are still people who were prisoners there, who are alive, survivors of that camp. Have you ever had the chance to meet a survivor of that camp, someone who was held there? And if so, what was that like?
After I moved to California, maybe 20-some years ago, I've been here about 30 years, I was watching a TV program that says Missing Persons. They started talking about, they were looking for an American soldier who was the first person to arrive at the Dachau concentration camp. I said, wow, I was the first guy there, I think. So anyway, they said this soldier came up to the camp, and he had a little American flag, and he handed somebody the American flag. And they told me when it happened. It happened according to the time that I actually did this. But when they said he had an American flag, I thought, I didn't have an American flag. Nobody had an American flag. And I thought, well, it's not me. Anyway, they ended up by explaining why did they want to find this guy. It was a group of ex-prisoners from the Dachau concentration camp in the New York area. I guess they met every year to celebrate their freedom, and they wanted to meet this soldier. They said, whoever it is, you're going to bring him to New York, and he will be a part of our anniversary celebration. I never got to see them, I've seen some old people in this area here that have been in concentration camps. And I'm always amazed at how good they look, in spite of how ravaged their body and their nervous system must have been. I'm amazed at the recuperative ability of a human being. It's unbelievable to me how we do recover. And so that's all I can tell you about remembering Dachau.
Well, you've told us quite a bit, and we wouldn't have heard it anywhere else. And who knows, maybe this program airing on all of our Hometown Heroes affiliates might lead to an opportunity for you to meet with someone who was there that day in April of 1945. Richard Morris of San Luis Obispo, California, has been our guest today. You'll find a few more of his stories on the extended podcast version of the show at hometownheroesradio.com. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time, and reminding you once more that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. Mr. Morris had a few more stories that didn't fit into our allotted time on the radio, but since you've found the podcast version here on hometownheroesradio.com, you get to hear some more of those vivid recollections right now.
I can tell you a funny thing that happened. We had an exercise where we were going to play. Some of us would be the enemy and some of us would be the friend. The whole point was we were to go out into the wooded areas. This is really the eastern part of Tennessee, I think it was. And that area was used a lot. I don't know what the farmers thought about it because we just went over everybody's farm and everything. Anyway, the night came. Well, we were to pitch our tents and go to bed. And then we were assigned guard duty in certain places. So I think about midnight, the sergeant said, "Okay, Morris, it's your turn to go out." He walked me way out into a thick woods. And it was one of those nights where you couldn't see anything. The moon wasn't out. And it was very cold. And so I was leaning against a tree. And finally I decided, well, I might as well sit down. And I sat down leaning against a tree. And I put my finger on the bullet, on the trigger, I mean. And I was probably half asleep when I heard some twigs breaking right in front of me. And I thought, my God, I'm going to be taken a prisoner here. So I just pulled the trigger, and of course the shot went off, and whoever was in front of me just turned around and ran as fast as he could away. And I stood up thinking, gosh, that was serious. That could have been bad for me, but I was worried that the bullets were filled with paper. I think it was colored so that if you hit somebody, there would be a spot on their clothes. And I was worried about shooting the guy in the head because he sounded like he was right over me. Anyway, I never heard anything about that. And the captain was so pleased about what I did that he asked the sergeant to let me move next to him, close to where the captain was. In the morning, we got orders to move out. It was probably before sunrise, maybe 4:30 or 5. And the sergeant said to me, "You go in and wake up the captain. So I went in and spoke quietly in his ear, and he didn't move. And I spoke louder in his ear, and he didn't move. And finally, I shook him and practically yelled at him, and he didn't move. And I crawled back out of the pup tent, and I said, I can't get him to wake up. And I said, you'll have to try yourself. The sergeant says, I'm not trying, you're trying. So I had to go back in and wake him up. And I pulled him out, practically. And he didn't wake up till he got practically out of the tent. Anyway, I was glad in one respect that I wasn't picked to be his runner, because he was a daredevil type guy. And in Germany, the guy that became his runner was in his Jeep. And he liked to ride in the front of the column, and like Napoleon. And he held on to the windshield frame, and he'd stand up there like, you know, I am victorious. And he got shot through the head, and the poor runner was in the seat right behind him, and his whole body went right into the in his lap. So I was glad I was never appointed as his runner. The captain said we could go hiking anywhere we wanted, as long as we went in a pair, and as long as we carried our weapons with us. So Bob and I climbed up this mountain, and on top it was like the beginning of Sound of Music. It opens up with the kid, with the lady and the kids on a little green spot. That's exactly where we were. I'm sure it was, could have been filmed there. We looked down. Well, anyway, behind there was a thick woods. And so Bob and I climbed up there for several days, and finally we decided, let's just walk back to the woods and see what's there. And each day we got deeper, and finally we got deep enough that we heard a guy chopping wood. So we take our rifles down, and we walk up, and pretty soon the guy sees us, and he puts his hands up, and we said, no, it's not necessary. We're not going to capture you. And he understood a little English. And so we went up and we got acquainted, and he said he was chopping wood for the cabin he had built for his wife and his two girls, so they could be there when the war reached the point of capturing Munich. Anyway, they were from Munich. And naturally, we started, everybody was trying to get food for all the people that wanted food. And he finally said, what do you do with the coffee grounds that you use in your kitchen? And we said, well, we just throw it away. He said, would you mind drying it and bringing it to us? That would probably really make us happy, because we have never had coffee, real coffee, for a long time. So we dried coffee grounds for him and took them back out. And he was so pleased, he said he wanted to invite us to their home for a dinner, or at least a lunch before we left. We never got to the home, but anyway, we did. He said we don't want to eat, because you don't have enough money to feed yourself, let alone us. Right. And so we went back, and he gave us some schnapps that you put a little bit of sugar with, right, and you drink it, and that's what we had. He told us that he was the superintendent of the Messerschmitt airplane factory north of Berlin. And he said the reason he spoke English is some of his engineering aeronautical training was done in England. And he said while he was there, he studied all of the literatures or magazines from the United States with aeronautical engineering. He said he was sure that America, if America entered the war against Germany, that they would lose, because he said American aeronautical engineering was really at the forefront of that field at that time. And he said he also realized we had resources, material resources, that they could never keep up with, not to mention gasoline. And anyway, he said he knew the war was over when we entered. And he said, but there's no way that I could express that without jeopardizing my life. And we asked him, how do you ever get down to Bavaria? And he said, I had a little plane, and I flew it down here, and I walked up the same hill you did and walked back in the woods, and I've been here ever since. Wow. So that was one interesting experience.
Yeah.